Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winder Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
And I'm Lara Chen Baker.
And I'm Bianca Bremhead.
Who's not here? Jackie Winder Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winder Group, which is a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. What originally started as a business conference for artists and fellow creatives is now being turned around to shine a light on our clients. From art buyers and creative teams to fellow producers and managers, this podcast is all about offering a glimpse into the work we do as the bridge between clients and creatives. It's an ongoing exploration of how to wrangle the creative process to achieve excellence no matter what the medium. Today, we continue our interview series and welcome to the studio Joanne Hook. Joanne is a consultant and coach to the creative industries and someone who has been instrumental for growing our own practices as producers and agents. But before we talk to Jo, Lara, how are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. It's a pretty regular Tuesday. Oh, it's Halloween. Ooh.
Spooky.
You're dressed like a pumpkin, actually. I've just noticed.
Well, yes, it took you long enough.
Oh, is it deliberate?
Yeah, of course it's deliberate.
It's less funny now.
And I'm also very rotund. And Bianca's not in today, so it's just me and you.
Yeah, but I'm sure she's pretty good. She's out at the Pop-Up Magazine live event in New York, and I'm very jealous.
Living her best life. So before we get into our interview, I think we'll go to some of the mini topics that have come in our professional development Slack channel. So first up, we have a bit of a language warning here for the site The Shit List, which is theshitlist.org. And This has been doing the rounds recently. I don't know who is kind of behind it, but basically
it's pretty new.
It is pretty new. It describes itself as a directory for creatives to publicly list truant and unpaid accounts, as well as to research new clients. I don't know how you're researching. How would you research new clients from this?
Well, you search a client's name and see if they have unpaid bills. But it's pretty, I mean, there's no checking or anything. Like, I mean, anyone could post anything about anyone. I'm going to start posting stuff about you.
yes, that is a bit concerning, that there is no kind of room for, it doesn't seem like there's, like, anyone can just kind of upload correspondence as well, like, also, which I'm not sure kind of, you know, the legalities of it. I think, you know, it's an interesting kind of concept.
I can see where it comes from, like the pain and frustration, you know, and financial strife from not being, not being paid for work that you've done, but I don't know if this is the right way to go about it.
Yeah, it's definitely a bit questionable, especially the fact that there are no kind of recourses for anyone to kind of say something. Like, at least at Yelp, if somebody is complaining that
I love Yelp. Some amazing
reviews. But it's reading the counter reviews, like the responses from the restaurateurs, is kind of the best part. But this is a bit of a one-way street. Look, I think its heart is in the right place in some ways, but there's definitely kind of some, it's a bit problematic in some ways. But look, it's a good start for a discussion that needs to be had in terms of how freelancers are paid, and, you know, the fact that it is sometimes a challenge, to say the least, getting paid and making a living as a freelancer. But yeah, I don't think we'll comment further on that, but we're just going to kind of put it up there for, you know, everyone else to have a look at and maybe let us know what you think. Laura, what was the next thing that came up?
This was an article, I think you posted it actually, it's on Quartz, it's titled, "To Give Better Feedback, You Must Fully Understand the Agony of Receiving It," and I think our guest today, Jo, might have a few words on this sort of topic as well. But this is a really, really great piece. This is an interview with a Harvard Law School lecturer, Sheila Heen, and she's the co-leader of their negotiation project, which I think we've talked about before. And basically, she's sort of devoted a lot of her career to trying to understand why accepting and following feedback is so difficult and how people can learn to internalize it with more self-awareness and objectivity. And it's a really interesting interview that hit home for me in a few places, because I suck at receiving feedback. I'm so bad at it. I hate it. I take things so personally, and it's so hard not to. And myself, it's something that I've really tried to work on over the last few years, to actually, rather than just getting defensive, like, make sure that I'm using that feedback to further improve myself. And when I do that, I notice that it has amazing results, you know. But anyway, it's quite a long interview, so I won't go too deeply into it. But, I mean, she talks about how, you know, receiving feedback is such a distinct leadership skill, and that in order to actually progress and to be a better leader, you need to learn this, you know, to learn how to do this. And that also feedback doesn't just necessarily come from, your immediate superior at the your performance review. Like, it's all about learning to receive feedback from your colleagues, from your partners, from whoever it might be, and taking in indirect feedback as well, like gestures and facial expressions and things like that, and actively asking for feedback.
Mm. Yeah, I really like the format of this piece as well. I mean, Quartz is doing some amazing journalism at the moment, and just kind of that this is a very kind of practical, is very practically written in terms of also just really trying to look at things from both sides. Like, you know, why are some people better than others at receiving feedback? Different kind of techniques like switch tracking and signposting that
there's a lot of funky words in here.
a lot of management speak, but again, this is kind of something I harp on a lot about, which is the whole idea of kind of looking at kind of how bigger organizations do things like reviews and trying to see, okay, how can something that worked in a 400 person business work in a 10 person business? And this is something that we kind of started doing around a year and a half ago when we started doing 360 reviews. We're letting everyone kind of review each other
anonymously.
Yeah, yes. which I think has been really kind of fantastic, and I kind of posted this article in Slack because I think it's important to give people that. It's not something you kind of can get trained for. Well, you can actually, but it is very difficult to learn how to give feedback, especially if you are in a production role where you have to kind of traffic sometimes creative feedback and work with many different personalities. But yeah, that'll be something.
And like, so often the focus is on learning how to give feedback well, but like, people sort of often ignore the other half of that. And like, what this woman talks about in this interview is how she and her team spent years like teaching people how to give feedback, but the results weren't really improving that much. And then they had this like brainwave and realized like, okay, perhaps we teach people instead how to receive feedback, and it just changed everything. And anyway. Yeah,
really good. And finally, we have a link from The Verge. We have a link from The Verge here before, which is interesting. This is a bit of a tech survey. Laura, you'll go into the content, but one thing I did really kind of love about this is their amazing use of animated GIF as kind of editorial artwork as well. I mean, that's something we're seeing a lot more of as, you know, in our work as agents.
Lots of great examples editorially recently. But yeah, you're right. This is a good one. But yeah, the article itself is basically... it's just called The Verge Tech Survey, and it starts, I guess, with a bit of an intro, sort of looking at how various tech giants have fared this year, from sort of Apple to Amazon to Facebook, Twitter, etc. And basically, the team at The Verge wanted to know how the public were feeling about these companies, so they partnered with a company called Reticle Research to conduct this broad survey on the public's attitude towards some of these sort of massive names in tech. And this is here now the first of what is going to be, a series of semi-annual Verge studies tracking the public's attitude towards these companies that we are so dependent on. So the study itself included around 1,500 people, and they made it sort of nationally representative of the US based on census data. And it's, the results for me, I don't think they were like that surprising, because they actually replicate my own feelings about these companies. So it was more just like, oh, people think the same as I do. Twitter sucks. Amazon's interesting. Keep an eye on it, you know. But still, they've got these like great breakout reports that you can read with these great sort of infographics that break it all down. Was there anything in there that you thought was particularly interesting?
Look, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, I love seeing information visualized. That there was definitely some novelty factor of that for me. I think I'm very wary of polling in general. I think especially after all the kind of, you know, I was following the US election so closely, and so much of that kind of relied on polling, and I'm not even going to get into that side of things. But yeah, like sometimes like I look at things now and I'm just like, what difference does it make? You know, I don't know. Like, I didn't really see this as, I think it's something that it's good to start doing, but I don't know like kind of what the actual kind of utility or end game is in terms of running this research.
I don't know. I mean, I just think it's interesting, given that these companies are now starting to control not just tech, but, well, it's more that tech is now starting to control everything. And so as tech becomes integrated with every single element of our lives, and these companies become the rulers of the world, essentially, I think it is interesting to see people's perceptions of them, and perhaps sort of like forecast a little bit where things might go.
Well, hopefully they're going for Mark Zuckerberg to actually put things on toast, because the whole raw toast eating thing is...
What raw... He doesn't have anything on his toast.
No, it's a whole video with him just eating a piece of raw toast.
That's disgusting. Yes. He should be jailed. Anyway.
It's really strange.
Moving on.
Moving on. I think, no, that was about it. There was one actually... I don't know how we can talk about this, because it's actually just an animated GIF of... of someone that posted, I think, Anna Jengelis at the Anaka just posted this animated GIF of, it's me, what's your rate, freelancer, what's your budget? And it's just this, it's this scene from, it must be Dirty Harry or some Clint Eastwood.
I'm too young, Jeremy.
It's really worth looking at. It's not something that we can actually talk about because it's really not funny when we
I told him this wouldn't work in an audio format.
I know, but I felt I had to mention it because I wanted to I wanted to signpost it to put it in the show notes, which if you want to receive, you can sign up at tinyletter.com/JackieWinter, where we put all of our show notes every week. And if you want to be the first to know when the episode drops, that's where you go as well. You can also visit our podcast page at JackieWinter.givesyouthe.biz. For many creative individuals and businesses in Melbourne, the name Joanne Hook will not be new to them. For over 25 years, Joanne has been a trusted advisor, consultant, and coach to some of Melbourne's most well-known creative brands, businesses, and individuals. On a personal level, Joanne has been instrumental in the growth of Jackie Winter for both myself and our team of producers here as we work together over the years. So we thought, as we continued along in our interview series, that we would bring Joanne to share some of her story and lessons learned with a broader audience. So with that, Joanne, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Our pleasure. Now, I think it would just be good to start from the top. And I mean, can you explain to our listeners and audience exactly what it is that you do?
Ah, that's a really great question. I suppose it's helping people to gain clarity around problem solving. And because I have a background in design, retail, like an assorted background, and my specialty is communication, I help people articulate the problem they've actually got and then help them solve it. So, you know, often they come just not sure what's not working, and I help them decide what's working, what's not, and then create a strategy around problem solving. That sounds like a really long-winded way of answering, but yeah, essentially I'm a coach, a mentor, and a communications specialist.
Excellent.
So, I mean, yeah, it's not a job that you hear a lot about. It's not something that they sort of show you at the career fair in high school or something. So, I mean, how did you even get on this path?
Wow. Yeah, exactly. It's actually not an elevator pitch type job. Very hard to nail it to one thing. And I often think about the scene in Pretty Woman, the movie, where she jumps into the car and he says, "What's your name?" And she says, "What do you want it to be?" And I tailor my answer to that question.
Although I imagine your jobs are somewhat different.
Yeah, they're really different. Sometimes I'm troubleshooting, you know, like with you, it's half-hour troubleshooting sessions and it's like bam, bam, bam. And sometimes it's workshopping things, and other times it's helping people get really clear on their long game, their big picture. So I started in design and millions of years ago in my other life, design clothes, and now I think I help people design businesses and their lives. But I came from a background of marketing and communications. That's what I studied, and that's what my first job was with the Just Group in the capacity of assistant to the advertising manager. So I was immersed in this sort of world, as well as fashion and design. So I had that communications and design, and then went on to have my own label of clothing and four shops and like retail wholesale manufacturing. Having lived that other life of having the large scale business and being very business focused, but also being a designer and a producer. So understanding the importance of having that big picture outcome, but also chunking back to being able to implement and put the details in place and produce something that was worth selling. And understanding sales and just business, that was my foundation. It's provided me with the toolkit, I suppose. But in about the around the late 80s, I did some business courses for entrepreneurs, and sort of decided that fashion wasn't it anymore, and had a greater sense of purpose or something that I wanted to do that was a bit more than fashion. It was about the same time that I had my daughter, so it was a turning point moment. And so I got into consulting with my peers and sort of realized that most of my peers weren't particularly organized, didn't have anything documented, would constantly grumble and groan at me that, "Oh, my staff doesn't do what I want them to do." I'd say, "How do they know what you want them to do? Like, have they got JDs and things?" And they say, "Oh, no." So it just started in a training capacity, helping people to get the most out of their people, write manuals. So a lot of my, you know, first 2-3 years of business was documenting systems and processes, because that's my brain works that way. Just realizing how important it is for people's peace of mind to know what it is that you expect of them and how to do things. So process, we know how important process is, and we know how important clear instructions are. And most at that time, the people I was encountering, they didn't understand the importance of clarity, of, you know, direction and instruction. So it sort of, it led to improvements in relationships. And that's where I was really, I got caught up in, wow, this has such a greater impact than just documenting systems. It really improves culture.
So that is that what it is about the job that you love?
Yeah, I love all of it. I actually really love still nutting out and brainstorming process with people and helping them understand the most efficient and effective way to get somewhere. But I also, it's the impact. Why that's important is because of the peace of mind. And, you know, in an epidemic of stress, peace of mind is really important. So just people having a clear sense of what's expected of them and what to do or where they want to go, that clarity is priceless. So clarity is probably what does it for me. So it's to see the lights turn on, or for somebody to say, ah, the penny dropped, oh, that's exactly what I needed to hear. So that sort of feedback loop, I think, great, my work is done. That's what I get out of it.
And you've been doing this for around 25 years now, is that right?
Yeah, since my daughter was born. She's 26 now.
Wow. It seems to me that you've kind of have a bit of a niche in kind of the creative industries in Melbourne. Like, would you say that's true?
Oh, definitely. I'm really blessed. It was at the beginning I worked in the rag trade because that was my industry and they were my peers. And then I started just getting referrals outside of the rag trade and worked with engineers and architects and, you know, and totally different fields, but the principles are the same. You know, everybody still wants to be clear on what they're doing. And so referral, for 25 years I've been referred. And then probably in the last 10 years, a niche has just formed where I suppose I've earned the trust of some people and they've just been so generous with referrals and it's just exploded.
Yeah, I think, I mean, one of the most interesting things from my perspective as a business owner and why we kind of engaged you, you know, many years ago is because, you know, you've been on that kind of other side. And whereas kind of, I think a lot of people who get into kind of coaching or consulting, you know, may not kind of have that experience or, you know, they take that experience and they, you know, apply to somewhere else. So I find it's a bit of an unusual path in that way, but, you know, but there's so much valuable information there. And I'm really kind of curious, you know, because you work with so many creatives, you help them become better communicators and help them navigate, I guess, some of the more non-creative roadblocks in that way. Are there any kind of, I mean, looking back over 25 years, are there any kind of bad habits or mistakes that you kind of see over and over again?
Yeah, I do. I suppose I've alluded to it at the beginning, but, you know, people don't document. They don't write simple systems. I'm a huge advocate for a plan, but it doesn't have to be a tome, like a 40-page thing, just the back of an envelope business plan that sort of clearly states where you want to go. So, yeah, there's definitely a distinct lack of written documentation. I think that the thing I experience most is most people are caught in their today game or their this year game, and they're not playing the long game of life and or business. And that's the thing that I'm driven to do, is open that conversation to a much bigger conversation, like how are these decisions going to impact your health, you know, your finances, your relationships. So that's definitely something common. People will come to me through crisis or a particular problem, and then I just massage the conversation so that it opens up to why is this important and, you know, how does it fit in, so there's more context, life context.
I remember one thing you mentioned, I think it was in a particular group session we had here, but that you said you see sort of is quite common, and it was sort of common within our own sort of group as well, was this idea of mind reading. You sort of, and I've heard you talk about it a few times, and it's like then something I've tried to, because I remember like it really resonated with me and I was like, I do this and so many people do this, and then I've tried to articulate it to other people and it just doesn't quite sound the same as when you do it. So I love to, like, yeah, I guess hear about that sort of that mind reading issue that so many people have. And
well, I think that it's it's a really common thing. I think, and it feeds into that conversation you were having about feedback and giving and receiving. I think that I might have read the same article and I just was nodding my head to the whole thing, saying you really need to learn how to receive feedback in order to be able to give effective feedback, because then you've had a bodily experience of it. Mm. But I suppose what stops us from giving and receiving feedback is we actually want to be liked. That's one. And you know, we take it as criticism, and I sort of say it's actually commentary. And if we can think about what our behaviour is, a dynamic of communication, of actions, of intentions, and that we're really just commenting on the dynamic for improving it. Mind readings, you know, it catches so many people. People will say, but I think that they're going to think badly of me, or I think this person hates me. You know, it's really extreme language. And I think, well, if you're in a mind read, because you actually don't know, I'll often say, how do you know that? Is there any evidence? Let's look for the body of evidence that proves that belief. Oh, well, there's not really. Yeah, okay, if you're in a mind read, you may as well mind read that they love you.
I find myself now doing that, like, a client perhaps has said something and I go to jump to a certain conclusion and I find myself, okay, how do I know? Like, I try to actively ask myself, how do I know that that's the case? And if I don't have any sort of actual reasoning, then I will just directly ask them, you know.
Yeah. It's a great strategy. That clarity is just, you know, just dropping judgment, dropping assumptions, and just asking some dumb questions, or just asking questions for clarity. It's like, okay, so how are you feeling about my performance? You know, it's very different to, oh, they hate me. Yes. If you I get a sense that you're not totally happy with me, and that might be your feeling. And I would really urge that, you know, people tune into their feelings, but it's really important to discern the difference between a feeling, like a gut feeling, and an internal chatterbox that's, you know, full of negative self-talk, feeding all of your worst fears about yourself.
Yeah, totally. I guess sort of continuing in that vein, what are some of the key issues that you find, you know, and what techniques do you recommend people to overcome these things?
I think we've probably covered so many in those, you know, those troubleshooting sessions that are really short. It's like the ability to say no with compassion, or to say no in a way that the person feels like you've said yes. That's a, like, it's a masterful aspect of communication. But it's also learning the importance of building rapport and building trust with people, which means you can say no a little more easily. So, you know, I don't think in 10 minutes I can give you a snapshot of how to say no, you know, effectively, but that's one of the most common things that I work with people. Asking for what you want, because once again, just as the little head will say, I think there's no way I'm going to get what I want, they won't have the budget, they won't, you know, they won't appreciate the value I'm giving. So say, okay, just ask anyway. Let's just start with the point of asking. Let them say no. Let them give you an entree to a communication so you can start negotiating. So the no, being able to say no, learning how to ask, just managing your internal dialogue. That's the, you know, one of the most stressful things is usually how people are talking about a circumstance or themselves to themselves every nanosecond that you're with them. So we all do it. It's just learning how to manage that and re-script it.
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny because so many of these things that kind of are essentially basic, but they're still so hard and they take a lifetime to master. I think we were talking before about what kind of feedback we get. And I think one of the best pieces of feedback for the podcast was one of our episodes where we were talking about just how to respect, you know, people, you know, how to respect clients. And it's like, that's something really simple, but apparently the way that we were talking about it, you know, maybe had resonated in a particular way, but
I mean, there are so many simple pieces of advice, whatever, that it's so hard to keep them all in your head at any one point.
Exactly. Yeah.
So literally just going over them over and over, the ones that are important to you or the ones that are going to most help your job, is really useful. Like, one of the things I remember, we've had so many sessions together now, Joe, but I remember, like, one of the things you said to me in an early session that has, like, really stuck with me and, like, genuinely shaped the way, and I think I've mentioned this in earlier episodes of the podcast, is, like, genuinely shaped the way that I write and the way that I communicate with clients, is that, yeah, that communication is, you know, 99% about the receiver, not about you. And because if it's not, I mean, the message is pointless if it's not received as intended, and, you know, and that the action that you're after doesn't follow, you know? So, yeah, that kind of thing, like, really, really stuck with me. And yes, it's sort of quite a simple concept, but it's one that I hadn't actually like actively thought about it. And once you'd like sort of lit that spark, I was like, oh, of course. Like, of course.
It's about them.
Yeah, and obviously you went into it a lot more detail, not just like one sentence. But
And I think that feeds into your comment, Jeremy, about respect. Respectful communication is them focused. It's actually, you know, being empathetic, stepping into the client's world, understanding what their parameters are, their outcomes, you know, having an outcome and sharing it. So there's so many really simple, you think, well, of course every meeting has an outcome. I'm here to tell you it doesn't. You know, so many ineffective meetings because they don't clarify the outcome. And client briefs, you know, how to discern a really effective brief is asking really good questions and getting clear on an outcome that's shared, have a common understanding.
Mm. Yeah, and I think in addition to that, I think for a lot of creative people as well, like sometimes you do know the answer is there, but you need to have a really good listener to, I guess, to have it reflected at you in kind of a different way. And I think that's, you know, that's sometimes that's kind of a service that's provided like through someone like yourself, or sometimes it's through a culture of people that feel like they can kind of talk to each other in that way. So the whole idea of the work that we've done, you know, there is no kind of magic fix kind of in that way, but there are kind of, you know, spot things that can be done as well as kind of this overarching kind of big picture work. But yeah, I find that creatives really kind of need that. And often when people come to me for advice, like, you know, that's kind of what I do as well. I try to kind of be that mirror. But I guess, you know, on the flip side of that, there are definitely kind of short, kind of, I guess, more kind of techniques and habits that are good to integrate. If you had to kind of just pick one thing, I know this is really hard. We're not kind of looking for free advice here, but to pick your brain.
I mean, we kind of are.
If you had to provide, like, I guess, a top tip to somebody in a highly reactive, fast-paced, negotiation-heavy production role to help them perform better and enjoy their job more, what do you think that would be?
Just an easy question for you.
It's a great question. It takes me in 50 different directions. I suppose the first thing that came to my mind is be clear on what's important. Like, very, you know, just clarify what are the priorities, because you cannot do everything well. So discern which of the things you're about to embark on are going to give you the outcome. And I think, you know, whether it's time management or priorities management, it's important to understand why you're doing something and how you want to feel at the end. So definitely a clear outcome, a sense of priorities, managing self. I just think, you know, having a degree of self-knowledge, like a commitment to personal awareness, developing a new script where you need a new script, you know, catching yourself being your best friend and then catching yourself when you're not being your best friend. So
I mean, that self-awareness can really be one of the hardest things to do. Yeah.
Yeah, and I suppose what you said, Jeremy, the repetition sometimes is where we've had constant sessions on the same sort of issue and you find different wording for the same approach, because understanding we all have different communication styles and different words will resonate with different people. So it's repetition, but it's always in a different form and it may be a different presenting problem. So coming back to your question, Jeremy, I think understanding the importance of language, that it's your internal tool and it's your external tool, and mastering it. And, I mean, this is your industry, visual and verbal and written language, and you're masters at it, and there's always something new to learn. So being open to that learning, and I love this, you know, this concept of sharing what you learn as well, because it's an infinite well of stuff to share.
So I guess going down a bit of a different track here, another aspect of your practice is NLP or neuro-linguistic programming, and there are a lot of sort of mixed responses to NLP. And yeah, we'd just love to hear a bit more about how you got into it, how you practice it with yourself, with your clients, and yeah, just your thoughts on it. And I guess firstly, does it work?
Well, for me it does. I found it really exciting. It's really a way of understanding how we think and behave. Mm. I think it's called the architecture of subjective reality. I thought that was probably the neatest definition, because as you say, it's had a bad rap and then some people really like it. I just think it's a great body of language and strategies that I pull on and use every day.
And how would you define that for, you know, someone who might not know what it is?
It's, well, as I said, it's the study of how we think and feel and how we behave. So it's, I think it's called a methodology, and I have to apologize for not having like a set definition of NLP.
No, we probably should have one, so don't.
Yeah, well, it's neuro meaning our nervous system, meaning referring to our programming, linguistic, the power of language to program ourselves, and programming meaning our conditioning, our beliefs and our values and how they play out in our behaviour and our results. So that sort of gives a broad idea of some of the approaches or doorways in to the work. If I'm consciously engaging NLP, there's some beautiful techniques around belief change. You know, so we hold beliefs as if they're reality. You know, and beliefs are just something we've told ourselves over and over and over again and haven't challenged. So having, if we've got really strong beliefs that are creating positive results in our life, we wouldn't want to change them. If we've got beliefs in our life that are actually defeating the purpose of our success, then we might want to mess with them. So NLP helps me mess with people's heads in a really positive way, or help them learn how to mess with their own beliefs. And
yeah, I mean, I guess it ties into lots of other practices in terms of like general therapy and like CBT and positive. Yeah, like it all sort of ties in, which is interesting. I mean, I myself, like, I've read quite a bit about it because I do find it really fascinating. I mean, like, I'm, my sort of number one passion in the world is language, and primarily the English language. And, you know, and it's funny because I'm always such a strong sort of advocate for, and, you know, someone who wants to be educated more about how language can be used to affect change sort of externally, and to communicate messages externally in different ways. And it's funny because it had never quite occurred to me how language could also be used internally to affect change within myself. And so, like, when I first came across NLP, part of me was like, is this like the secret? Like, I don't really, because that to me is kind of like, make a mood board of a car that you want and it'll just arrive. But I agree that there's definitely something deeper than that in terms of like changing a mindset, stopping you from, you know, holding yourself back.
That's a great way of putting it. Changing mindset. It's programming. Yes. Computer program metaphor is a really good metaphor, because if you change one aspect of a program, you change its results. And if you're not happy with the program, you know, if QuickBooks has been fantastic and they've discovered Xero's fabulous. And it really is a matter of changing programming. And that's from language to beliefs to values, thoughts. So thoughts being silent language. And the awareness around that, because most of our behaviour, like 98% of our behaviour, is based in the unconscious. Yeah, and so we're really only in control, consciously in control of 2% of our behaviour. So
That's
NLP, is a great tool as a practitioner to tap into a person's unconscious behaviour, because it leaks out in their language. You know, people's values, that's where I focus a lot of my work, understanding what's important to somebody. So I help them design a life that's based on what they find is important. That leaks out in ways that they often haven't realised. You know, they'll be telling me poignantly that, you know, their health, their relationships and feeling stable and secure matters, yet they're crazy busy at work and not spending any time with people. And you think, okay, so there's a misalignment here, and they probably haven't heard it themselves, or they're just in stress mode and can't get out of it.
Your sort of underlying values, morals, belief systems, whatever you want to call them, would, I guess, affect or drive, I guess, almost every decision we make in our lives, whether that's, really observable or not.
And
it's interesting.
There can be conflict too. And that's often what I'm working with. If somebody's describing in a business or in a personal scenario that they want something, and then they're telling me that there's two conflicting things. Like, often people will use the language, on the one hand, there's this, and on the other hand, or there's a part of me that says this and a part of me. So in NLP, there's great parts integration exercises where we get to find out what's the highest purpose of both of those scenarios, because both of them want the best for you. It's weird language, I know. And so I get to understand how to merge both of those values into a new value and actually articulate the new outcome that they want. And in doing so, they integrate their value system internally.
And then I guess with the rest of your work, I guess then helping them to build some sort of plan to reach that kind of end goal?
Yes. Yeah. So steps and strategies. So a lot of it's thinking, you know, understanding a new way or experimenting with new ways of thinking. But it's always translated into behaviour because we have to have the proof. You know, it's not done until we get the evidence.
Obviously, NLP is a, you know, is a kind of tool for you that you are passionate about. I'm assuming just as you might see mistakes that a lot of people make kind of as a trend. What about the flip side of that? You know, you work with a lot of creative people and creative businesses. What kind of skills or habits do you see those people using that you think are vital or kind of a bit of a repeating characteristic for successful people that you work with?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the people that have a connection to a bigger picture, like a greater sense of purpose, are the businesses that tend to work better because there's a why that's really clear and the what sort of comes out of that or how comes out of that. People who have clearly defined their process tend to be more successful and have more ease in their work and find it easier to employ people because, you know, they've got that clarity. It's easier to induct somebody and bring them on board. Those who are really clear on their non-negotiable values, because, you know, whatever business you're in some form you're in service, and like deciding and clarifying what sort of service you want to be is paramount. I think those who understand money are probably, you know, that's quite rare sometimes when I meet with people. Often there's a quite a negative or just a naivety around money, or even a I'm not driven by money comes out of people's mouths, especially creatives. And we sort of, I think once we get through that and say, okay, let's not demonize money, let's understand it and have be at one with, or, you know, start to make friends with what money represents rather than money as something evil, that tends to preempt a new level of success because it's just a different part of the game of business. So I just think people who are organized tend to have a better experience of their work, and those who are committed to self-care and have some sort of discipline or practice where they take care of themselves and acknowledge that, you know, just like on the plane, you're meant to put the mask up to you first, that it really is important as a business owner to take care of yourself. And, you know, as I know you do, it's that being able to give of yourself because you've given to yourself, and nurturing and caring for the other aspects of you that aren't the business person.
And I suppose that's true in life as well, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
In any other relationship. I'm wondering, what's the best piece of advice you've ever received? I know that's such a cliche question.
It is, and I've actually thought a lot about this. I think my mum brought me up on a diet of musicals and like great music, and often messages were given through the words of a song. And there was a movie and a live play that I went to see as a kid, and it was Mame, and in it there's a line, a song called Open a New Window, and it's all about opening a new window and opening a new door every day, so that fresh start and starting with that. And then in my later life I was introduced to Buckminster Fuller, who's a bit of an inspiration for me. And in the foreword of one of his books, the first line is, dare to be naive. And that's probably the thing that in this work drives me every day, because when I meet a new person, I never assume I know anything. I sort of think, I consciously decide I don't know anything. It's like I'm a blank canvas. I need to listen, learn, find out this person's map of reality. And you have to at some point be naive to have that, you know, have the capacity to sort of to forget what you know and be present to whomever you're with.
So just to wrap up, Joe, if people want to learn more about you, you know, your practice and your kind of thinking, where can people do that?
Well, they can check out my website, which is www.joehooksolutions.com.au.
Excellent. We'll put the links to that in our show notes as well. And is there any other bit of advice or words of wisdom you want to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I'd just like to say thanks for inviting me. It's an act of generosity. I think the podcast is another demonstration of your part in this industry and how generous you are. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you for sharing your wisdom with us, Joe. Thank you so much.
And again, we didn't pay her to say this. Thank you so much, Joe.
Wrapping up like we do every week, going to the most Melbourne and New York thing that we've seen in the week.
Except no New York thing because we have no Bianca.
Except no. We could probably, though, like run it through some kind of like generator that would kind of give us like, you know, some kind of New York
hoverboards.
Thing. Yeah. Subway, guy, man bun, bats.
Hippies.
Ending up
Halloween.
Yes. Halloween.
Well, that actually, that is my Melbourne thing at the moment, actually.
All right, Jeremy, what's your Melbourne thing?
Well, no, I mean, I think it's Halloween.
My Melbourne thing is that you've got a Melbourne thing for once.
Like every week, it is a bit more abstract. It's just the fact that, like, I don't know, like, you know, I've been in Melbourne, Australia for like 16 years, and like the first 10 to 12 years, like Halloween was just not a thing. And then all of a sudden, it is a very Melbourne thing now. There is like, there's Halloween decorations, there is, you know, the whole kind of the candy. It's like, you can't even like go any place, like, you know, the big.
You are gesturing so wildly right now.
I am gesturing. Well, I don't know how I feel about it, especially with the whole pumpkin thing, because like the whole finding pumpkins in Australia thing, I don't know, maybe I need to find a support group for other Americans who feel about pumpkin the way I do. But anyway, I'm gonna put that aside. I'm just going to say, look, I'm glad Halloween is in Melbourne. I think it's a good thing. But it is a very Melbourne thing for just kind of jumping on the bandwagon of something that America did for a very long time and thinking it was very cool.
Burn.
Not throwing any shade on my adopted hometown, but yeah, that's my most Melbourne thing.
Be careful, we'll kick you out. My Melbourne thing is like also not particularly Melbourne. It's just a thing that happened to me that was like amusing. So hopefully no one complains. I was on the weekend, my partner went away to see his family in Queensland. And he runs a gym that's like nearby. And I got this very frantic message from him. Oh my God, like I think I've left one of the burners on in the kitchen in the gym. And like, can you please go get the spare key and check? And me being the wonderful girlfriend that I am, I like said, yes, of course. Okay. And I was walking the dog anyway. So I was like, I'll walk down there. But I went a little while after his message. So anyway, I wandered down and I had to get the key from the cafe next door. And I sort of know them all because I go in there every day after I go to the gym and they handed me the keys and I went sort of unlocked the roller door, unlocked the main door. And I had the dog with me and we like started walking in and then I just heard the dreaded beep, beep, beep. And I realized he hasn't given me the alarm code and the alarm's about to go off. And I have no idea what I'm going to do. And there was no one else there. And yeah, I mean, it suddenly starts, it's like full on alarm starts sounding, but it's not just like, because it's this big warehouse. So it's not just like the inside alarms. There's like sirens outside. And so the cafe next door, there's like people sitting out the front and everyone's like covering their ears. And like, and I sort of run back out and I run to the cafe and the staff are all just dying laughing because they know that it was me that set it off. And I'm like, please tell me you know the code. No one knew the code. I was like, there's two other businesses in there. So I was like, tell me you have their mobile numbers. Meanwhile, I'm messaging Dan madly like, you didn't tell me the fucking alarm code, blah, blah. And he's on the plane already. So I know that the messages aren't going to be going anywhere. But anyway, eventually plumber showed up. He had the code. I had the keys. And with our powers combined, we solved the problem.
And the gas wasn't on.
Oh, yeah. The burner wasn't even on.
There you go. A siren going off in a warehouse. A truly Melbourne event. Thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you, Bianca.
Thank you, Jeremy.
This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Areej Noor. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Especially if you have someone that would be a good person to interview, we would love to hear from them. We've got some great recommendations so far, so please keep them coming. You can also sign up to our weekly podcast-specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/JackieWinter to get all of our show notes and notifications when episodes are available every week. Archives of all of our shows and show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check his stuff out at soundcloud.com/JackieWinter. If you love what you hear, you can really help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and giving us a little comment. Details, again, on our website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.